welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gather to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, we're at the Campbell Creek Science Center for a fireside chat given by polar bear biologist Eric Regeer from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Eric's research focuses on how climate change is affecting the survival and abundance of polar bears in different parts of the Arctic. He earned a B.S. in chemical engineering from the University of Kansas in 1998 and ultimately went on to complete a Ph.D. in zoology and physiology from the University of Wyoming. Eric began studying polar bears with the U.S. Geological Survey in 2002 and has been with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service since 2008. He spends part of each year in the Arctic performing hands-on research, and he's interested in improving the field and analytical methods used to study polar bears and other animals. Eric also collaborates with native peoples and others living in polar bear country to assure that the traditional subsistence harvest of polar bears occurs at a sustainable level. His talk, entitled Polar Bears and Climate Change, The Future of an Arctic Icon, was recorded at the Campbell Creek Science Center in Anchorage on Wednesday, December 15th.
Oh, thank you. And I have to second the big thanks to all of you for braving the cold temperatures and the winds in some places to come out and listen. As Louisa said, my name is Eric Regeer. I'm a biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service here in Anchorage. And the title of my talk tonight is Polar Bears and Climate Change, The Future of an Arctic Icon. I'm going to start and present quite a bit of background on polar bear ecology and also on the research methods that we use to study polar bears. I'll briefly list some of the major conservation challenges that are facing the species, and then go into more detail on two case studies for well-known and well-studied polar bear populations where we found out a lot about how climate change and sea ice loss is affecting these animals. I'll talk about what scientists know about the potential future of polar bears in the sea ice habitat. And then, time permitting, come back to some of the things that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and others are doing to protect polar bears. And lastly, some suggestions as to what anybody that's interested can do to safeguard polar bears for the future. So, this is a view of the world, kind of looking down at the top. The North Pole would be right in the middle of that circle. And polar bears occur throughout the circumpolar Arctic. Pretty much wherever you can find sea ice, you could find a polar bear. And very roughly, that corresponds to the area that's been shaded green on this figure. Now, the world's population of about 20 to 25,000 polar bears have been divided for management purposes into 19 subpopulations, as indicated by all the lines on here. And of these 19 subpopulations, two of them occur within Alaska. And the first is the Southern Beaufort Sea population, which is shared with Canada. And the second is the Chukchi Sea population, which is shared with Russia. Now, the scientific name for the polar bear is Ursus maritimus. And if you translate that, it means sea bear. And indeed, it's an appropriate name because polar bears spend most of their lives out on the sea ice, and they depend upon it for nearly everything that they do. This includes their long-distance movements. These are among the most mobile four-legged animals in the world as far as the area they cover each year. Polar bears also rely upon the sea ice as a platform for their mating activities in the spring, and also some of them build their maternal dens. Some pregnant females build their maternal dens on the sea ice in the autumn. And most importantly, polar bears rely upon sea ice as a platform from which to access the seals that make up most of their diet. And this is an adult female and her two-year-old cubs that had just recently killed and consumed a ring seal. So this is going to be a very simple representation of the Arctic food web. Life in the Arctic Ocean starts with the sun, which will shine into the cold waters and promote the growth of tiny plants, phytoplankton such as diatoms. These will be eaten by little zooplankton, little animals such as copepods, be eaten by fishes such as Arctic cod, which are then eaten by seals. And so up to this point, all of the life or all of the energy in the Arctic Ocean has taken place in the water, under the sea ice. But when you get up the food chain to seals, some of this energy is transferred to the surface of the water when the seals come up to breathe or to haul out. And at that point, it becomes available to the polar bears that are waiting on the surface of the sea ice. And so this just emphasizes that, polar bears are completely dependent on sea ice as a platform from which they access the rich energy and life of the Arctic Ocean. Here's some pictures of the polar bear's main food items. Throughout most of the range, polar bears eat mostly ring seals. These are smaller seals which can get up to about 100 pounds. And a particularly important component of the bear's diet is the ring seal pups in the spring, which, unlike the older animals, are white, such as the cute little guy in this picture. And the bears will access these pups by breaking into. They'll get up on their hind legs and, with their front paws, crush into the snow layers, the snow caves, where these pups are born and are sheltered for the first few weeks of their lives. And that's what had happened where this picture was taken. Polar bears also eat some bearded seals. Now, because these bearded seals are much larger, they can get up to 800 pounds. We think it's usually only the big male polar bears that can actually successfully catch and eat these bearded seals. And finally, because polar bears are, at the end of the day, bears, they'll eat pretty much anything they can find. And that includes sometimes these beach cast carcasses of bowhead whales or other marine mammals. Well, this is a bit of a gruesome one when you make it really big, but I put this picture in here for two reasons. This is an adult bearded seal that had just been killed by a polar bear a few minutes before we got there. And the two important or interesting points are, for one, just the size of this thing. They're huge animals. And second is that some places here you can see where the polar bear started to strip off this thick layer of fat. And indeed, it's again, these... rich marine resources that have allowed polar bears to evolve into these specialized predators that can not only survive in the harsh Arctic environment, but are the largest four-legged carnivores in the world. And sometimes when I'm flying in the Arctic and you see a bunch of these seals hauled out on the ice edge, it just reminds me of almost a buffet of big, huge, fatty sausages for a polar bear that might be walking by. It's really impressive. So by accessing all these fatty seals, polar bears can grow to very large sizes. This is a picture that I took last year of what I believe is the largest bear. It's not the best picture, but the largest bear that's ever been sedated and weighed and released again into the wild. This was in the Chukchi Sea, and this bear weighed 1,353 pounds. So they're really big. It's really hard for me to understand how large and powerful these animals are. Now, as big as they are, they start out life less than 2 pounds and completely blind. And so to protect them from the harsh, cold Arctic environment, they're born into caves that their mothers excavate in snow drifts. And here's the entrance to a maternal den. Even when it's really cold and windy and nasty outside, it's surprisingly comfortable inside these dens. The dens are big. You can get in and crawl around, as in this picture. So polar bear cubs are only about 2 pounds when they're born. These two pictures are at 6 and 12 weeks. As they're getting a little larger, females usually have two cubs, so we'll have little guys like this. And this is what the cubs look like at about 4 months. In the spring. And this is also the time where we can potentially capture and release them for research. And so this is usually in April or May, and just after the polar bear cubs have left the den with their mother and started their lives out on the sea ice. So these guys will probably weigh about 20 pounds apiece. As I said, female polar bears usually have two cubs. In rare instances, they can have three cubs. This is actually a female with 3 1-year-old cubs. Which was a really neat thing to see out on the sea ice last year in the Chukchi Sea. And these cubs will stay with their mothers for another year after this until they're about 400 or 500 pounds apiece. So female polar bears really invest a lot of energy in raising their young. Now, although polar bears depend on sea ice for just about everything they do, all sea ice isn't the same for polar bears. Specifically, they really prefer the sea ice that occurs over shallow waters of the continental shelf. So here's Alaska, and then the lighter blue in this map is parts of the ocean that are less than 300 meters deep. And I'll illustrate this with the locations of some polar bears that we've been tracking recently. And also this purple area is the much, much deeper waters and less biologically productive waters of the polar basin. So in March when this image was taken, this light blue layer represents the fact that the whole area was covered by sea ice. And here are the locations of the polar bears that we were tracking. And you can see that out of all the area that they could have selected for, they chose these shallow waters near shore. And so it's really this habitat preference of polar bears for these biologically productive waters where seal densities are thought to be the highest that'll become important when we start looking at how polar bears are responding to sea ice loss and climate change. So much of the scientific information that we have about polar bears comes from actually going out over the sea ice in a helicopter and physically immobilizing a small number of bears. We'll sedate the adults by darting them from the helicopter, which I'll show a little bit more about later. Sedate the little guys really gently by hand. And when we do that, one of the first things we do is we apply individual markings to each bear. We'll give them a tattoo on their lip and a little plastic ear tag. And I've gotten some examples of the ear tags up here. And the purpose of that is that we can follow the fates of bears through time and tell one bear from another. We'll also take a suite of measurements and biological samples. We'll take small bits of hair, fat, tissue. One of the most important things we do is we fit some of the bears with these tracking devices. And these GPS devices will provide real-time location via satellite on where the bears go and what they do long after we've left and the bear's gotten up and gone about its life. And that's some of the real important information that allows us to understand how polar bears are distributed over the sea ice, how they're using the sea ice, and also how they're responding to changes in their environment. So some of the tracking devices are in radio collars like this. And an important thing to point out is that all the collars we put out have these automatic release devices, so they'll drop off after one year. And we do that to try to minimize the inconvenience to the bear and also make sure that bears aren't carrying around collars that have dead batteries that aren't providing us with information. And then recently, we've started trying to go to these smaller and lighter tracking devices, such as this ear tag. And I've got a little, it's not a real one, but a mock-up one out here that you can take a look at as far as the size and the weight. So this is new technology that we're experimenting with. So because polar bears occur at very low densities in a very large and remote area, one of the most challenging aspects of polar bear research is simply finding them. So again, we'll basically take the helicopter out, we'll fly over promising, good-looking polar bear habitat until we see a bear, or more often until we see polar bear tracks in the snow. When we see tracks, we'll often land and try to assess the freshness of the tracks. If the track looks fresh, we'll follow it in the helicopter, and then if we're lucky, we'll find a polar bear at the end of it. If the bear's in a good area and it's otherwise safe to proceed, we'll try to sedate the bear by the person in the back seat of the helicopter firing a dart at it. So after that dart is in, the bear will go to sleep in a few minutes, and at that time it's safe to get out and unload our equipment and start the study. Now, when we're on the ground with the bear, it'll be asleep and we'll be down with it for about 30 minutes to an hour. And our goal is really to try to maximize the amount of scientific information we collect and minimize the amount of stress to the bear. Two jokes. We certainly want to avoid things like this. And so the bear in this cartoon is saying, well, Doc, I think I may be addicted to tranquilizers. And, you know, I put this in again as a joke, but it actually relates to a more serious point. And that's, you know, when studying polar bears or any animals, we have an ethical and a scientific duty to try to do it in as humane a way as possible. And also only to do studies that can actually provide a direct conservation benefit for the species. And so that's something that we take very seriously. Yes?
Excuse me, how fast do they run?
You know, for short periods, they go fast. And I'd say 25 miles an hour, that's just a wild guess. Not as fast as a horse, but for short periods they can go fast. Actually, one of the things we have to worry about the most is because these animals are so well insulated, they have thick layers of blubber, and they also have these insulating coats that you can come up and feel. If we chase them during research for more than a few hundred yards, they can actually get hyperthermic, they can overheat. So they're made to walk long distances, but not to run for long distances. They're ambush predators.
They pant like a dog.
They do. They'll blow off huge amounts of heat. Excuse me. So onto the conservation challenges. The largest conservation challenge facing polar bears is loss of their sea ice habitat associated with climatic warming. And I think that most of you are probably familiar with the basic science of climate change, with the recent finding that the warming of the climate system is unequivocal, and in the last 50 years it's likely caused by humans.
You said they were the only animal that in historic times have occupied the same areas?
No, they're the only large carnivore that doesn't live in the water. The only large carnivore that currently occupies nearly all of its historic range. So if you think about lions, tigers, you know, all these animals, if you look at maps, as far as I'm aware, they've all been reduced greatly in their extent.
So what is historic?
Well, and that's a good question. I mean a few hundred years ago.
So not through any climate cycles?
No. Throughout their evolutionary history, which it could be up to a few hundred thousand years, their range has surely contracted and expanded multiple times. So I just mean in the relatively near past. So over the past 100 years, the surface of the Earth has warmed by nearly a degree Celsius. And one of the effects of this warming, along with changes in atmospheric and oceanic circulation, has been a reduction in the extent and in the thickness of Arctic sea ice. And so if you look back at the years where we have good satellite data, there's been an average loss of about 8.5% of the summer sea ice extent per decade. And so to put some perspective on that, that's equal to the loss every year of a chunk of sea ice the size of the state of Missouri. If you look at this figure here, the heavy red line shows actual data on the observed summer Arctic sea ice extent and shows its decline, along with the record low of 2007 and a few years since then. Now, all the other lines on this figure are the predictions of sea ice extent from climate models developed by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And so there are two points to take away from this figure. The first is, all those squiggly lines are predictions from different models from different scientists throughout the world. There's a lot of variation among them, but as you move forward in time there on the x-axis, they uniformly and consistently predict declines in sea ice extent. So that's one point. The other point is, if you go back to the observed sea ice decline, which is the heavy red line, it's more rapid than is predicted by all but the most extreme climate models. And this is a picture of what it actually looked like this year. So again, we're looking down at the top of the world. The white is the sea ice. This pink line is the average September sea ice extent going back to 1979. And so it kind of looks like, you know, someone took a funny-shaped bite out of a funny-shaped cookie. And something that's relevant to us in Alaska is the area that's experienced the greatest sea ice loss occurs off the coast of the Southern Beaufort and the Chukchi Seas. And this is actually one year, this is a picture just representing one year, but this is a trend that's fairly consistent over the past several years. Other conservation challenges for polar bears that I'll just mention really briefly here and then return to later, depending on how much time we have. One is the need to identify and implement sustainable levels of subsistence harvest. Commercial or sport hunting of polar bears is illegal in the U.S., but here in Alaska and throughout the Arctic, polar bears play an important cultural, traditional, and nutritional role in the lives of some native peoples and communities. Another.
Is there a limited number of polars they can harvest?
There is, and I'll discuss, hopefully talk about that a little bit more later, but yeah, we work closely with Native partners to establish guidelines or limits on subsistence harvest to ensure that it's sustainable. And finally, increased human activity, oil and gas development, shipping, and other things in a warming Arctic. So what I'd like to do now is talk in a little bit more detail about what scientists have found from two of the best studied polar bear populations regarding how changes in the climate and sea ice loss is affecting polar bears. And to start, I'll go to Western Hudson Bay, Canada, which is highlighted in green there. And there are about 935 polar bears in this population. So here is a more magnified view of the study area. This white is Western Hudson Bay. Here's the town of Churchill. And then below that, in that black line, is the part of the coast where we actually captured and released polar bears for the study I'm going to describe. Now, the ecology of Western Hudson Bay is characterized by a complete annual ice cycle. So in the fall and the winter, everything's ice covered. Polar bears are distributed on the ice. In the spring, the ice will melt. Bears will become concentrated in progressively smaller areas. Until late July, the whole bay is ice-free and all the polar bears have come ashore. And importantly now, polar bears will remain on shore and completely cut off from their sealed prey for about 4 months until the bay refreezes in November. And so during that time, they depend on their stored up fat reserves for energy. So in the past 50...
They don't hunt on land at all?
There's just not a lot for them to hunt on land. They're opportunistic if there's goose eggs or...
There's caribou in that area, though.
There are caribou.
They're back and forth. Studies.
Yeah.
Seasonally.
There certainly are caribou. There have been a few cases of polar bears, observations of polar bears taking caribou, but in general, they're not successful at it.
Not like the seals.
Yeah, and also if you think about a caribou versus a seal being a much fattier, more energy-rich animal than a lean caribou. So they're generally not taking advantage of terrestrial food sources. Yeah. So in the past 50 years, the spring air temperatures in Western Hudson Bay have increased by 2 to 3 degrees Celsius. And one of the effects of this warming has been that in the spring, the sea ice now melts or breaks up about 3 weeks earlier than it did 30 years ago. And this is a concern for polar bears because it forces bears off the sea ice and onto shore earlier. It shortens that spring foraging period when they're taking advantage of ring seal pups and gaining all this weight that they need to survive the summer on shore. And so indeed, past studies have showed that the body condition or the fatness of polar bears has declined in recent years, and it's also been related from year to year with when the sea ice melted in the spring. So the data for this study consisted of over 3,300 polar bear captures from 1984 to 2004, and these captures were accomplished by the Canadian Wildlife Service. Yes?
When do they hibernate?
Well, most polar bears don't hibernate. The only polar bears that enter dens in the winter is usually pregnant females that are going to give birth. And they do that, again, to provide a warm, sheltered place for their cubs. Most other polar bears, males, young polar bears, non-pregnant females, are active throughout the year. So in addition to these bears that we captured for research, we also looked at data for problem bears that came into the town of Churchill that I showed earlier. When bears come into town for reasons of public safety, they'll be captured and detained. When that happens, a record of the bear's identification is made. Now, the number of problem bears coming into Churchill, as this figure shows, had generally been increasing since 1991. And actually, a similar phenomenon was observed in other communities, just more bears coming into town. And so by looking both at research data and records for problem bears, we were able to evaluate these apparently contradictory phenomena of, on one hand, a population that appears to be under increasing nutritional stress. On the other hand, more bears coming into town, which led some people to conclude that the population was actually growing. And what we found from the study was pretty interesting. So for prime adult polar bears, that's animals between 5 and 19 years old, survival was fairly high and it was constant over the course of the study. For juveniles, subadults, and senescent adults, so for all other age classes, survival varied from year to year and was generally declining. Now, interestingly, we found that the best predictor of survival was the spring sea ice breakup date. And so what that means, in years with a really early sea ice breakup, survival was very low. And the magnitude of that effect was such that if the sea ice melts 1 week earlier than average, it corresponds to a decrease in polar bear survival from about 2 to 5%. Yes. Well, what we believe was happening is that in years where the sea ice breaks up earlier, again, polar bears are forced off the sea ice and onto land earlier. So it shortens that spring period where they hunt seals and gain weight. They spend a longer time on land in worse nutritional condition, and we hypothesize that increases their chance of starvation in the coming year. And so that's what results in the declines in survival. We also found that over this study, the size of the Western Hudson Bay polar bear population had declined from about 1,200 to 930 animals. Now, despite the fact that there were fewer bears out there every year, apparently a larger proportion of those bears were coming into town. And we hypothesized this was, again, because bears were in poor nutritional condition, and therefore more of them were encroaching upon human settlements and looking for food. And so, and if you've ever been to Churchill, this all makes sense. The dump is closed now, but they used to have an open dump, and you could drive out to it, and just like in this picture, I think there's six polar bears that are obviously finding something good in the dump. And then finally, in addition to being the first study that really provided a quantitative scientific evidence for a link between sea ice loss and decreased polar bear survival, the study also highlighted one of the important and kind of insidious side effects of climatic change, and that's the potential for more human polar bear conflicts as hungry polar bears come around people looking for food. I'll move now a bit closer to home to the southern Beaufort Sea polar bear population. So research in the southern Beaufort Sea has occurred for over 30 years, led by the U.S. Geological Survey Alaska Science Center, which is also here in town. And this is my friend and colleague George Derner, who's the head of the USGS Polar Bear Program. The data for this study consisted of about 1,100 captures of polar bears from 2001 to 2006. And where we here in the U.S. and our counterparts in Canada capture polar bears are shown on the map there by the black dots. Now, similar to Western Hudson Bay, we found pretty strong evidence for an association between sea ice loss and declining survival for polar bears. This table shows survival rates and breeding rates for adult female polar bears from 2001 to 2005. And as you can see, in the first 3 years of the study, survival was high, which is good for bears. In the last 2 years, survival was very low, which is clearly bad for bears. Furthermore, we found that these changes in survival rate and breeding rate were correlated with the number of days per year that the waters over the continental shelf were ice-free. And so 2001 and 2003, the ice-free period over the continental shelf was relatively short. Polar bears had more time in the spring and the fall to spend in their preferred habitats hunting seals, and survival was high. In 2004 and 2005, the ice-free period was nearly a month longer. Polar bears had reduced access to seals, and survival and breeding were much lower. Before I go forward, I'll mention that subjectively here, we called, we call it 2001 to 2003 with the short ice-free seasons and good years for polar bears, 2004 and 2005, poor years for polar bears. So we found a similar relationship between the frequency of these poor ice years with long ice-free seasons and the long-term growth rate of the population. And so put more simply, as sea ice conditions get worse in the southern Beaufort Sea, polar bear deaths start to outnumber births and the population will decline in size.
You're listening to Addressing Alaskans with polar bear biologist Eric Regeer from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. His talk entitled Polar Bears and Climate Change, the Future of an Arctic Icon, was recorded at a fireside chat hosted by the Campbell Creek Science Center on December 15th.
So based on these relationships between sea ice conditions and survival rates and breeding rates, we could look forward as to what the future might hold for polar bears in the southern Beaufort Sea. So what this figure shows is the probabilities that this region will experience a poor ice year characterized by sea ice conditions which are hard on polar bears, and how those probabilities change as we go forward in time. And again, this information comes from climate models developed by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And as you can see, there's quite a bit of variation among models, but similar to that previous figure, all the models kind of predict the same trend. They predict that sea ice conditions will get consistently worse in this part of the world in the next 100 years. So if this happens, the outlook for the southern Beaufort Sea population is pretty bad. One of the main limitations of this study, these predictions forward in time for 100 years are based on a 6-year study. And that's actually a big limitation. It's a level of detail that sometimes don't go into, but it's a very astute question. The Arctic environment is extremely variable. It's very hard to predict what's going to happen in the future based on what's happened in the past, especially what happened for only 6 years in the past. And so that's one of the major sources of uncertainty in these predictions, yes. So moving on, if the sea ice changes that way, and if the relationships between survival and sea ice are the same in the future as they were for this shorter study, the outlook for the population is not good. So if we look 45 years into the future, there's over a 60% probability that the population will face severe declines, possibly to extirpation, which means polar bears disappearing. Going farther to 90 years in the future, this probability of a severe decline goes up to about 90%. Other studies in the southern Beaufort Sea have provided other evidence for increased stress associated with sea ice loss. There's been a long-term trend toward smaller and thinner bears. This is an example of what a really skinny polar bear looks like. We captured this adult female in the southern Beaufort Sea in 2006, I believe. As the sea ice that's out there becomes less available and less stable, there's also been a shift from more polar bears denning on the sea ice to more polar bears denning on land. Another kind of unpleasant picture, but we've also in some areas, some years, had an increasing frequency of reports of a very skinny or emaciated polar bears. And this guy's actually an interesting story. This is a 7-year-old male that was shot in the community of Barrow as a problem bear in 2008. And here where he was shot in 2008, he actually weighed less than he had weighed when we captured him as a 2-year-old for research purposes. So this is a guy that clearly, looking at him, it looks like a 2 or 3-year-old bear, although we knew for a fact that he was 7. So he's a bear that clearly didn't make it. Now before moving on, I want to provide a bit of a broader view on the current status of polar bears. This table summarizes the current status of all 19 polar bear populations in the Arctic. So right now I just talked about the two best studied populations. It also happens that in both of these areas there was strong evidence for negative effects associated with sea ice loss. The point is, however, that things aren't uniform across the Arctic. If you look at the other 17 polar bear populations, some of them are declining as well for a variety of reasons. A few of them appear to be increasing, and for the majority of them, we simply don't have enough information to know what is going on. So when people ask me very generally, how are polar bears doing, the point is it's not a simple answer. It depends on what part of the Arctic you're talking about and what time frame we're talking about. Now, despite this variation in the current status of polar bears, one thing that all these populations, or most of them, do have in common is concerns for the future associated with sea ice loss. And we can actually use what we learned in these case studies in Western Hudson Bay and the Southern Beaufort Sea to help to predict how these other populations might respond to sea ice loss that occurs in the future. There certainly are areas that are better and worse. At least from 2001 to 2006, the southern Beaufort Sea was probably one of the hardest hit populations throughout the Arctic, although it's really hard to say that without having good information on all the other populations. So we've really placed a lot of emphasis on these few areas where we have these long-term studies to gain some insights on how sea ice loss and climate change is affecting polar bears. Yes?
But the key there is, what is long-term?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. When I'm talking long-term as far as a scientific study, 30 years in the science world is very long-term. Obviously, on geologic timescale or other timescales, that's not. So it is very dependent on what timescale we're looking at, yes. So moving on, what does the future hold for this species? So we already saw that a lot of the climate models developed by scientists throughout the world predict continued declines in Arctic sea ice. And so now we can take a more detailed look on how these sea ice declines will affect the availability of the most important habitats for polar bears and how that can also affect polar bear numbers and distribution. An investigation of this issue was led by Steve Amstrup and George Derner, the two fellows that have been pictured so far, and the U.S. Geological Survey, Alaska Science Center here in Anchorage. So the first thing they did is built what are called resource selection functions. And these are models that indicate what characteristics of the ocean and the sea ice are the most important to polar bears. And they built these things by bringing together movement data from polar bears that were wearing tracking devices, oceanographic data, such as how deep different parts of the Arctic Ocean are, and sea ice data from remote sensing and imagery. And what they arrived at was a very detailed picture about what characteristics of sea ice are most important to these animals. They found that polar bears prefer areas of medium to high ice concentration. They select for ice over the shallowest water possible, ice that's near land in winter, and ice that's near an ice edge, or the 15% ice threshold. Now, put more simply, this generally supports the statement that I made earlier that polar bears require this relatively thin annual sea ice that occurs over the biologically productive waters of the continental shelf where there are the most seals. So now that we know what it is about sea ice that's important to polar bears, we can start looking at how the availability of this most important or optimum polar bear habitat has changed. And so this is another map of the Arctic, again looking down at the top of the world. Alaska's right here. And this map shows changes in optimal polar bear habitat for the past 20 years. So what actually happened? And the red in this map shows areas that have lost optimal polar bear habitat. So as you can see, there's been a bit of variation around the Arctic, but one of the reddest areas, one of the areas that's experienced the greatest losses, is again here in the southern Beaufort and Chukchi Seas. This is a similar map, but this time instead of looking back 20 years at what actually happened, we're looking forward 50 years at what we predict will happen based on these same climate models. And it's kind of a similar picture. Again, the map is dominated by red, which indicates loss of optimal polar bear habitat. Again, some of the greatest losses occur here off the coast of Alaska, which would potentially affect our polar bear populations. Now, the only exceptions to this is some areas of higher latitude and some areas along the Canadian Arctic archipelago where sea ice is expected and polar bear habitat is expected to persist more so for the next 50 years and actually to increase slightly in some areas. Now, to try to make the final step to say what these changes in optimal polar bear habitat, what effect they could have on the actual number of distribution of polar bears, we defined what we called four ecoregions. And these are broad regions of the Arctic that were chunked off based on similarities in sea ice dynamics and similarities in polar bear ecology. And so of the two populations that I've talked about so far in detail, the Western Hudson Bay population occurs in this green shaded or seasonal ice ecoregion. And so that's a part of the Arctic where the ice forms and then melts completely each year. The Southern Beaufort Sea population was part of the purple shaded region here, which is the divergent ice ecoregion. And again, that's a place where the ice will form in the fall and winter and then melt partially or be carried away by currents in the spring and summer. The point here is that for each of these ecoregions, the USGS built what's called a Bayesian network model. And this is basically a model that pulled together everything we've talked about to date. So it's what science knows about polar bear ecology, it's what the sea ice is going to do in the future or may do in the future based on climate predictions, and it's what relationships we've observed between sea ice availability and polar bear population dynamics. The model also included other things that we haven't talked about, such as a potential conservation risk associated with things like contaminants, disease, and increased shipping. And so a lot of information went into this. When possible, this model was built based on actual data that have been collected by scientific studies. However, for a lot of this stuff, actual data don't exist. And so the model was based in part on the expert opinion of polar bear scientists. So when we run this model forward in time for each ecoregion, here's what it showed about how polar bears are likely to fare. So the two ecoregions for which the Bayesian network indicated the most severe negative impacts on polar bears was the two that we've been focusing on, which is the seasonal ice ecoregion, where Western Hudson Bay is, the polar basin divergent ice ecoregion, where the Southern Beaufort Sea is. And what these colored bars show going forward in time is a relative probability of different outcomes. So what the models indicated is that in both of these ecoregions, the most likely outcome in the next 50 years was for polar bears to face severe reductions down to possible extirpation. In the convergent ice ecoregion, things aren't so bad. The models indicated that there is also the possibility for extirpation, but that's not as likely to occur until 100 years out. And that's because, as we saw on that Arctic-wide map, sea ice loss in this convergent ice ecoregion is expected to occur later on. Yes. So the question is, did we distinguish between extirpation and extinction? Extinction, and I'm using terms kind of loosely here, we defined it as a reduction to a very small percentage of the original population size in that region. And these terms are a little bit nebulous for really mobile animals like polar bears, which can actually clearly move between these ecoregions. But talking in general terms here. And finally, the fourth ecoregion where things look the best was this Canadian Arctic Archipelago ecoregion. This is the high Arctic where sea ice is expected to persist for the longest. And so here, the most likely outcome was the persistence of polar bears in 100 years, but possibly at reduced numbers. So going back to the map, onto which the world's population of about 25,000 polar bears has been distributed among the ecoregions. If sea ice loss continues as projected, and the projections from this model turn out to be correct, and it led to the near loss of polar bears in these two ecoregions, in the next 50 years, that would equate to the possible reduction of the world's polar bear population by about two-thirds by 2050. So clearly, looking forward, if climatic warming continues as projected, the outlook for polar bears is pretty grim. Indeed, it's this concern that led the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to list polar bears as threatened under the Endangered Species Act in 2008. Now, I do want to make the very important point that it's certainly not too late for this species. And there are two things to emphasize. The first is, and this was touched upon earlier by a question from the audience, there's just a lot we don't know. If you envision the entire Arctic becoming ice-free, that certainly would result in dramatic reductions to the numbers and the distribution of polar bears. More specifically, there's a lot of scientific uncertainty about how sea ice reductions are going to affect polar bears, and also, more generally, are going to affect this large and variable Arctic ecosystem. So there's just a lot of uncertainty about these things, especially in the short term. Second is that all of the predictions and pretty much everything that I've talked about has been based on climate models that assume what we call a business-as-usual greenhouse gas emissions scenario. Basically, that means that there's not going to be a lot done to address climate change. That it's going to continue, that the concentrations of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere will continue to increase for the next 100 years. Now, fortunately, that's not the only future that's possible. If we collectively limit greenhouse gas reductions, take steps to slow down or reverse climatic change, it is much more likely that the sea ice loss will persist into the future, and therefore that polar bears will persist into the future. There was actually an article about this in the Anchorage Daily News today, and tomorrow in the journal Nature, a new study by the U.S. Geological Survey will be released, which demonstrates alternative and much more hopeful futures for polar bears if climate change is addressed more aggressively. Yes. So the question is, how adaptable are polar bears, and are they capable of changing food sources? And it's a very good question and a tough one. I personally think polar bears are very flexible animals. They're very smart and very individualistic. I think if you hung a peanut by a string, 20 feet off the ground, a polar bear would get it. I think the question, however, really comes down to is, if the sea ice disappears, what food would be available to polar bears? I mean, if they're cut off from these energy-rich marine resources, even being as adaptable or as flexible as they want to be, what could they find to eat? If you look at the Arctic terrestrial ecosystem, it's fairly energy poor. There's some caribou, there's sedges, there are ground squirrels. There aren't rich fat seals. The other thing, if you look at the Arctic terrestrial ecosystem, this ecological space for a large omnivore or a large predator is already filled by the brown bear. And I've had a friend who studies both species describe polar bears as brown bears on Valium. These are pretty, unless they're motivated, they're much more timid, risk-averse creatures than brown bears. So the thought of them out-competing these brown bears, Arctic brown bears, that are already very well suited to life on land, it seems quite improbable. Yes. So the question is, what are the physiological differences between brown bears and polar bears? And I can't answer physiologically very well. The two species can breed and produce viable offspring. The polar bear is thought to have evolved from a brown bear up to a few hundred thousand years ago, so clearly there are a lot of physiological and genetic similarities between the two. Physically, polar bears are very different creatures. They have elongated jaws, much different claws, different pelage, and so there are a lot of physical differences between the two that reflect the polar bear's specialization toward being a pure carnivore on the sea ice.
So if sea ice loss continues, what happens to the ring seals themselves? Are they going to be okay, or will their populations crash as well?
Yeah, the question is, how is sea ice loss going to affect ring seals? And then, you know, beyond that, all the other animals that are living out there. And that's a good question. There's much less information on how climatic change might affect ring seals than there is on how it might affect polar bears. However, the federal administration responsible for managing ring seals has come out and expressed severe concern about the future of that species. And again, it's because ring seals, like polar bears, do rely upon the sea ice for some of their important life functions. They give birth in snow caves that are on the sea ice, and they use it to haul out and rest. So yeah, these climatic changes could have effects on all levels, all trophic levels, from the plankton up through the fishes, through the polar bears. And so we're just focusing very simply on one species here. So now I'm going to move toward the end of the presentation. Excuse me, by talking a little bit about what the Fish and Wildlife Service and others are doing to try to protect polar bears. The mission of the Fish and Wildlife Service is working with others to conserve, protect, and enhance fish, wildlife, and plants in their habitats for the continuing benefit of the American people. So, as part of the federal agency responsible for managing polar bears, the Alaska region of the Fish and Wildlife Service has a broad range of initiatives aimed at polar bear conservation. And I'm just going to focus or mention three of the main areas that we're working on regarding polar bear conservation. One common theme to most of what we do is co-management. And what co-management means is working closely in close partnerships between federal agencies and native organizations. And that, again, is something that guides a lot of what we do at the Fish and Wildlife Service. And there's several reasons to do that. First, it's supported by law. But second and more importantly, our experience here in Alaska and the experience throughout the Arctic indicates that these close partnerships are the only way to effectively promote conservation of these Arctic species. And if you think about it, that just makes sense. People in polar bear country have been living there successfully with polar bears for thousands of years. And so they have a unique insight and perspective that we need to take advantage of to continue living successfully with polar bears. It's certainly important what we do and say about polar bears here in Anchorage or what's done and said in Washington, D.C. But at the end of the day, some of the most direct aspects of polar bear conservation take place in areas where these animals and humans actually come into contact. So it's critical that we work with local communities and native organizations in conserving this species. And this is a few polar bears feeding on the remains of bowhead whales up in Kaktovik. So one of the things that we're doing is polar bear research. Now, as I mentioned, the southern Beaufort Sea population on the north slope of Alaska has been well studied by the U.S. Geological Survey for the past 20 years. On the other hand, the Chukchi Sea population, which is here on the west coast and shared with Russia, has not been well studied, and we currently don't know very much about it. So clearly, to make sound management decisions, We need reliable information on things like the health, distribution, survival, and size of this polar bear population. So to address this need, the Fish and Wildlife Service, along with the U.S. Geological, initiated a capture and recapture study in this west coast of Alaska in 2008. To date, we've captured and released 143 polar bears, and that's using the methods that I talked about earlier. And just to give you an idea of what this type of study entails, here's a map of the west coast of Alaska. This is the Lisburn Peninsula here with the town of Point Hope. And the black lines on this map show the helicopter track logs. So that's the areas in 2010 that we actually flew around looking for polar bears. And all the little red dots show areas out on the sea ice where we actually physically captured and then released a polar bear. So we're currently analyzing these data and hoping to continue this study into the future. Another primary goal of the Fish and Wildlife Service is to work with native partners to ensure that the subsistence harvest of polar bears occurs at sustainable levels that don't harm the population. I mentioned earlier, polar bears have been harvested in the Arctic for thousands of years. They play an important cultural and traditional role in communities. And there's, especially in the southern Beaufort Sea, a long history of successful harvest management with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as an advisor to an agreement between the Inupiat of Alaska and the Inuvialuit of Canada. And these native organizations, via this agreement, have set voluntary limits or quotas on the number of polar bears that are harvested each year. And for the past 20 years have kept harvest levels below these quotas. Polar bear harvest in the Chukchi Sea is actually managed under an international treaty between the U.S. and Russia that was signed into law in 2000. And we just recently, in May of this year, had a historic development under that treaty when in a meeting here in Anchorage, Alaska, sustainable harvest limits were set for the first time for polar bears in the Chukchi Sea. And that was done based on a consensus of native, federal, U.S. and Russian wildlife managers. So that's something that we're very excited and hopeful about, and we hope will really improve the long-term conservation of that Chukchi Sea population. And a final area where we're focusing a lot of energy is to try to minimize and mitigate human polar bear conflicts. The obvious reason to do this is to protect polar bears. As we know, living here in Alaska, when humans and animals come into conflict, it's usually the animals that lose. For large and powerful animals like polar bears, it's also necessary to protect people. And so this picture shows a fellow being chased around his truck by a polar bear up in Kaktovik. And I think this was 07 or 08. And I was actually up there and talking to this guy, and he told me about it before I saw this picture, and I thought he was exaggerating. So, fortunately he got away, but clearly this is the type of situation that can turn out very poorly and that we really need to avoid in the first place. Now, like we saw in Western Hudson Bay, in many parts of the Arctic, there appear to be an increase in the number of human polar bear conflicts. And this is something that, as climatic warming continues, we expect will continue to increase. And there are a few main reasons for this. For one, there's high public interest in polar bears. In Churchill, Canada, and even starting in, a little bit here in Alaska, there's a lot of interest in an active industry for viewing polar bears, so polar bear ecotourism. As we all know in Alaska, there's also increases in the amount of industrial and other human activity in the Arctic, such as the oil and gas development on the North Slope. As I mentioned earlier, in some parts of the Arctic, the length of the ice-free season is getting longer, and so polar bears are spending more time on shore where they can come into contact with humans. And finally, the potential for more nutritionally stressed bears to be hungry, again, approaching human settlements looking for food. So this is an issue that we're really devoting a lot of attention to and trying to get on top of, along with our partners in the local communities. So to do this, the Fish and Wildlife Service has a long-standing mitigation program in place on the North Slope oil field through which we work closely with industrial partners to try to minimize the impacts of their activities on polar bears. And we're also active in the communities. This shows a large carcass of a bowhead whale that's being harvested for subsistence purposes. Earlier, we looked at a few polar bears that were eating the remains of a bowhead carcass. And so one of the main things we're doing in the communities is trying to minimize all types of food and attractants that bring polar bears into town. We're also implementing polar bear deterrent programs, polar bear patrols. The idea there is that when a bear comes near humans, to haze it away in a non-lethal way, so to get it out of town without killing it, basically. And this picture shows a fellow on foot with a flaming torch scaring a polar bear away. And I have to add the caveat that this is from a polar bear patrol in Russia, not necessarily one of the methods that, well, certainly not one of the methods that we recommend or practice here. And finally, a big component of this is education and outreach. We want to promote the exchange of information between scientists and residents in polar bear country, try to come up with the most effective ways to avoid polar bear problems. That's a bearded seal on the Chukchi Sea and her new pup there. So, those are a few of the areas that the Fish and Wildlife Service is just focusing energy. And I put one last slide on the topic in here, and this was more for if there was a younger component to the audience, but unfortunately there isn't, but hopefully some of this is relevant to you guys. And these are some simple suggestions as to what anybody that's interested can do to affect or promote polar bear conservation. And the first thing is just to be informed and be active. Polar bears can really touch on a lot of political and emotional issues. And so unfortunately, there's quite a bit of misinformation out there. So if you want to know about polar bears and get reliable facts, I suggest going straight to the source. And a great way to do this, perform a Google search on some of these organizations, the Polar Bear Specialist Group, Fish and Wildlife Service Alaska Region, or the U.S. Geological Survey Alaska Science Center. Another thing you can do for anybody that's concerned or has questions about polar bears is just write the Fish and Wildlife Service. And I guarantee that we take these letters very seriously to consider and try to respond to. An easy way to get involved is to support non-governmental organizations that are involved in polar bear conservation. And two good examples of these are the World Wildlife Fund and Polar Bears International. This is a reminder more to myself than to any of you. Is that one of the best things we can do to address the larger concern of climate change is to adjust our lifestyles. This means doing things like reducing, reusing, recycling, riding a bike, and in general, trying to live energy efficient lives. And finally, I put a catch-all because I'm sure there are a lot of great suggestions out there that I haven't thought of, and so this is creative suggestions that my small brain has not thought of. So in closing, I think the main point to make here is that polar bears depend upon sea ice. And in the long term, what happens to the sea ice will happen to polar bears. If sea ice loss continues as projected by climate models, we could see loss of up to 2/3 of the world's polar bears in the next 50 years. However, as I said, it's certainly not too late. If we can limit greenhouse gas emissions, slow down or reverse climatic warming, there's a much higher chance that polar bears and their sea ice habitat will persist into the future. And in the meantime, have an automatically disappearing bullet there. In the meantime, the Fish and Wildlife Service and others, which hopefully includes some of the people in this room, are working hard to help protect polar bears, help them remain a healthy and functional part of their ecosystem, and to survive the challenges that are coming. I do have to acknowledge and emphasize that all the information that I presented was the result of the work of a lot of people and organizations. And then finally, and most importantly, to thank all of you again for coming, listening so patiently, and asking good questions. And I'll open the floor up to more questions if we have a few minutes.
You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with polar bear biologist Eric Regeer of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. His talk, entitled Polar Bears and Climate Change, The Future of an Arctic Icon, was recorded at a fireside chat hosted by the Campbell Creek Science Center in Anchorage on December 15, 2010. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our website at kska.org. where you can also find links to all of the local groups featured on the show each week. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to kska.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.